So good morning to all. It's a pleasure to welcome you here to New York City. I apologize for the gray skies. I'm Rob Lustrin from Reed Smith. And our panel is interestingly named The Energy Transition, Is It Still Happening? I will reserve judgment on that even despite what the last two panels had to say about it. But, we're witness to a very interesting time. Government with changing governmental policies and relationships between the countries, changing from day to day. Energy policy still remains the driving force behind geopolitics. And here in the U.S., as we've heard, the Trump administration has announced a policy that can be encapsulated in the catchphrase, drill, baby, drill. Our shipping industry must continue to grapple with our now long-standing aspiration of a zero-carbon future in light of these changing times. Historically, the shipping industry has been at the forefront of key environmental protection and safety initiatives, double hulls, scrubbers, and integrating new technologies to increase efficiency and safety. The IMO adopted its first GHG reduction initiative in 2011, with key decarbonization milestones remaining set for 2030 and 2050. And there's a little, there's a 2040 thing, but they really call that a checkpoint along the way. And we're still looking at achieving net zero GHG emissions by 2050. So our panel today will focus on the state of our industry's efforts to decarbonize in the global fleet, where we are now, and where we are headed. So let me introduce our expert panel of industry experts. I'm not going to go in any particular order. So Craig Caney is the regional manager for Maritime Americas at DNV. Humaira Ahmed is vice president of legal and business development at Lisker, the Liberian ship registry. And congratulations to you, Humaira, on the Liberian registry being the largest ship registry in the world by gross tonnage. That's a pretty good milestone. John Lacouris, who's sitting right next to me, he's a director and the head of energy transition at New York Stock Exchange listed Dorian LPG. Dr. Lucas Barmparis, the president of NYSE listed Safe Bulkers down at the end. And Jesper Bo Hansen, group director of global commercial and decarbonization at V Group. So let's kick it off. Has a zero carbon ship left port? Let's begin with John to my left. Can you briefly summarize Dorian's views on 2050 and the zero carbon future, and what is Dorian doing to achieve it?
Thank you, Rob, and thank you for the introduction. Good morning to everybody. The decarbonization effort of the shipping is a complicated effort because it is multifaceted. You have a number of tools that you could use for your ships to improve not only the efficiency, but also their emissions and their performance. So Dorian has been working on this for many years. We have a fleet of 25 very large gas carriers, and those ships have been fitted since early on with scrubbers. They are more than almost 20% of our ships are dual fuel, which use LPG as fuel instead of fuel oil, which is another step towards becoming a little bit more carbon sufficient or reduction of carbon. We are also looking at our operational performance, our technical performance, and also, of course, biofuels will help us go to the next steps that we need to do before we do items like wind assistance with perhaps sails or rotors or other methods. Carbon capture is another one. And, of course, hybrid battery systems are items that are in the toolkit for the future. So that's how we see that we should be able to move into the 2030s with our fleet. Our fleet is about 10 years old. It's a fairly young fleet, and we think that we have a good strategy and plan for the future. Thanks.
Let me ask the same question to you, Lucas, and then we'll come down the line. How is Safe Bulkers addressing the decarbonization effort?
I think.
Just speak.
Hello.
Okay. We started from during the period of COVID-19, and the main challenge for our company was to address the renewal of our fleet. As we know, dry bulk fleet is quite aged, and most of the ships are not so efficient. So we started with a renewal program, which is 18 new build vessels, phase 3 vessels, as we call them, which represent a 30% reduction of CO2 emissions, and basically 30% improvement on efficiency. And this was done at very competitive terms for contracts that were contracted back during COVID period and just after. I can say that the average age of the average cost per contract is about between 33 and 35 million, which basically makes an investment in the environment at very attractive prices and bringing down the overall consumption. At the same time, we had a very extensive upgrade program on environmental investments, which include low friction paints and ducts and various other things, which probably make our existing fleet by 10 to 15% more efficient. All these efforts were done, and while each year we are able to bring down the CO2 emissions in terms of AER, at the same time, we maintain our competitiveness because all our vessels are considered to be up to C category. We don't have D and E vessels in our fleet. In parallel, we are able to charter this fleet out basically on average by 10% above the index, which represents substantial profits for the company in return for such investments. Having said all these things that we are doing, because we have an existing fleet and we need to renew the fleet, the company has also made an effort to open up towards new alternative fuels. So we are one of the few companies that have a couple of methanol dual vessels that will be delivered to us the next couple of years. And in this respect, we also have an open eye towards the future, towards the next decade, where, let's say, all this taxation and we start biting a lot. Overall, I feel that we need to be adaptive because the carbon the decarbonization path is very challenging. The humanity has gone was quite successful in several tasks in the past. For example, the transition from leaded to unleaded petrol in cars, the transition, the clear up of the industry, the abolition of CFCs, which destroyed the ocean, and we cannot fail on this new task because it's very important. But we need also to be adaptive to what the societies need. So I think that as you make the reference, drill, baby, drill, and all the other efforts to use CO carbon are basically a response to the needs of the society for cheaper energy. So the legislators need to find a way. There will be back and forth, but I think overall the route is already towards decarbonization, which will come. We cannot say exactly when, but it will come in the following, let's say, a few decades. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucas. Jesper, how is V Group is seeing a broad swath across your many clients? How are you viewing this?
So we are obviously very agnostic when it comes to how we are approaching it, because we are doing it on behalf of our clients. However, in order to satisfy a diversified fleet and a diversified portfolio of clients, we are investing into a knowledge base around alternative fuels and a lot of alternative energy saving devices. So from that perspective, as a group, I think the main investment lies in being on the forefront of understanding what is required, and then to the best of our ability, ensuring that we can advise our clients, both from what is regulatory required, but also from what would be commercially recommended. And as we see an increase in sort of the traction of commercial dialogues versus energy saving, it becomes quite clear that the complexity around how to position yourself and what to do on a technical operational from the technical operational aspect becomes much more complex and complicated. So a lot of our conversations internally and externally are obviously how do we best solve for what is the future, but equally so operating a fleet of more than 500 vessels for a large contingency of clients, we also have to be quite engaged on how do we improve what is already on the water. And we spend significant time on that.
Nara, same question to you.
Well, thank you, Rob. And good morning, everyone. The Liberian Registry has a three-prong approach in energy transition. One, we've been working with owners, classification societies, shipyards, in developing technologies for the energy transition really since 2016. Some of the technologies include carbon capture, all the alternative fuels, LNG, ammonia, methanol, you name it. We've also been involved in electric sea gliders. And we also, as a member state to the IMO, we also have a seat at the table where we set forth regulation towards decarbonization. And as a flag administration, we enforce those regulations. So we have a very significant role in the role of decarbonization.
Craig, what's the view from DNV's bridge?
Thank you, Rob. Great to be here. And maybe to wrap up, we'll actually answer the question, is the energy transition happening? I think the answer is yes, and it must continue. But we always have to kind of consider that this has always been a marathon and not a sprint. We're going to see periods of acceleration like we've done in certain segments with container ships, PCTCs, where over 80% of the new builds have been all using alternative fuels because it made sense from a business perspective to do so. But we'll also see periods of uncertainty, and I think we're seeing quite a bit of that now. We see that starting from the Russian-Ukrainian war, which was happening in the Red Sea, what's now happening in the U.S. and the new administration. So these uncertainties are causing hesitations. So this period will slow it down, but that does not mean that the transition is not happening. We'll also continue to see countries investing in fossil fuels, as not should not be surprising, as energy demand and energy security has to be vital. Actually, if you look at the fleet, for the worldwide operating fleet, we are still operating on 92% conventional fuel. So as a shipping industry, fossil fuels will still be a reality that we operate in. But at the same time, we see significant investments in renewables and the green energy transition, as well as regions in the world, specifically kicking off in the EU, that are very steadfast in their commitment to the decarbonization goals. And I think as a global shipping industry, we are as well. So from a D&V perspective, we always say collaboration is the fuel of the future. So we look to collaborate against across all the value chain. We look to work with yards, ship owners, ship managers, OEMs, and the flag states to really look at how we develop regulatory roadmaps to kind of deal with this kind of complex landscape we're in. We are also fuel and technology agnostic. We really want to look at what does it take to do this safely, not only for our industry, but more importantly for the seafarers that are on these ships day in and day out, making sure that they can adopt these technologies and fuels in a safe manner. We do that through introducing rules, regulations on new technologies, as well as the new fuel types, things like methanol ready, ammonia ready, and the like. Finally, we look at DME to educate and share information. We do that through reports such as our Energy Transition Outlook, Maritime Forecast 2050, where we look to share insights and strategies on how the industry can transition to low carbon and net zero fuels. We can't do it alone, and we have to do it together.
Well, Craig, that was great, and thank you for confirming that the energy transition is still happening. We appreciate it. Let me stick with you for a moment. So who's really leading the charge here? Shipbuilders, oil majors, other energy providers, the owners? Who do you see as really out in front of the decarbonization effort?
I think if you look at that, it's very much dependent on the segments. You know, if you look at the statistics, as I mentioned, your containers, owners, PCTCs are driven by their customers. So the customer's customer who are driving these kind of adaptations. So you see that with an 80% plus alternative fuel, dual fuel rate. Where if you look at more maybe the commodity shipping, your tankers and your bulkers, the ROI just doesn't make sense yet to make that happen. So from segment to segment, you're going to see that shift, but you also see the shipyards investing in new technologies, investing in new designs to make sure the transition happens, as well as the collaboration between flags, class societies, and the like. So it really is just dependent on the business case that sits and the direction going.
Okay, I assume, John, that you agree with this coming. You're a gas company, gas carrier company. We have a bulker owner down at the end here. Do you agree with that characterization that across the different sectors there are varying degrees of emphasis?
Generally, it's customer-driven, I think, more than it is, even though the shipyards would like to say that they're doing a lot of research to move the things along. I think the owners are the ones that are moving things along and demanding better, improved design ships that can do better performance, are more efficient, and have more features to be able to work into the 2040s and 2050s. Because if you're building a ship right now, you're going to be trading that ship well into the 2050s.
Yeah.
Or maybe late 2040s. So you really need a ship that can manage the transition into more efficient and less carbon, better carbon emissions.
Lucas, I assume you agree.
Yes, I would like to go a step back because, okay, it's customer-driven, but the customers, let's say all the ship owners that want to buy a ship or to make an order, they shouldn't be placed in such position. I would say that in previous, let's say, transition, say leaded to unleaded or for cars, everything was designed by the manufacturer. So there was technology there. The cars were pressed, the manufacturers were pressed from the technology, from the legislation to produce, let's say, more efficient cars, etc., etc. And that was the result. Now everybody says we are agnostic, and I agree we are agnostic because we don't have developed the technologies. We need to understand why this does not happen. And this does not happen because for so many years we are used to burn fossil fuels, and this is the cheapest. Because if we put a price on the, until now we put a price on the fuel. Now we want to put a price on the oxygen that the fuel is using to be burned and produce the energy. So it will be more expensive. And in this respect, then the legislators come and play a role because they put some, let's say, a transition path, which we all know, and then it's here we are, where we're trying to find a solution to cover this gap and how to achieve this path. I think there should be some more fairness in terms of in relation to the shipowning companies in terms of the industry, because we don't need only legislation to dictate the path, we need also solutions, and the solutions should be there when we make a new order. And of course, for us, we made a new order in a couple of ships, dual fuel methanol ships, because we said, okay, if you take a delivery of a ship in 2026 or 2027, and you have all these new regulations that are coming into force after, and they will bite after 2030, basically, you cannot stay silent. You need to do something. And you go and you take a risk, which you don't really know if this will be the fuel of the future, but you take the risk.
Understandable.
So I think that more effort is needed in terms of the ship owner, of the shipping industry and the technology to meet the problems.
Yeah, Humera, you look like you're itching to comment here.
But if you look at ship type by fuel type, particularly on the new build side, it's clear that the container ship owners are leading the charge, right? So, and they have a lot of capital to allocate, and they're allocating it towards LNG and methanol. So, you know, by 2028, I think your DNV report indicates that there's going to be 1,300 LNG ships operating on LNG, and then you're going to have 400 ships operating on methanol, and most of them are going to be container ships. So, I think it's the cargo carriers that are really leading the charge in pushing those container ship owners to invest in alternative fuel.
Yeah, Jesper, what are you seeing in terms of ordering, crew training, and the like? And like, where are the ships coming from now? We have this whole thing coming down the pike here where it seems like Chinese-built vessels may face increased port costs. Do you see more discussion of ships being built in Korea and Japan, say, for example? Or will China be back, kind of in front?
I think the jury is still out on that. First of all, I think I've just been in China, and it seems like activity in China has not, so far, not reduced. And I think for those who have been involved with China for a number of years would also realize that if the international buying contingency in China goes down, then they will find ample domestic demand to build ships and finance it for themselves. But I think it's true that you know, we also make investments that sort of go across. While we don't own the ships, we make continuous investment in crew training. We have 45,000 crew in our company, and those are obviously spread out amongst a large number of different clients and a large number of different vessels. We've invested into being the only strategic partner to the MMM Center for Zero Carbon Shipping, which means that everything that goes on the forefront on how to handle different kinds of fuels in the vessels and the designs that are coming for the future, we're sort of on the forefront of that. And what we are trying to do, of course, is that all of what we do, which we do every day, specifically across 500 vessels plus in a full management, but across many more ships that we touch through various services that we do, is that we try and align and compile all of that data and bring it back into how can we best serve the one and the individual client, right? And we've seen it. There is an increased complexity in how you operate and manage ships. You know, last year we were doing an acquisition with a listed company at the time, Bell Ships, where we carved out their entire technical and operational management to create an efficiency around their capital structure and around their ability to position themselves in the market. And, you know, so with all of these things, I think training, knowledge becomes increasingly important. And I think it's interesting that Dr. Lucas is telling us that they are actually starting to evaluate themselves on CII. I think it's not more than 12, 18 months where all of us in this room were trying to stand in line to say that CII is not working. And it probably is not working for a lot of different reasons, but the reality is that now we have a listed company promoting themselves as being primarily a C and being able to accomplish a better rate, which I think is exactly what we need to hear. Those are the kind of conversations that we need, because what does that feed? That feeds others thinking, oh, I don't want to be the next best, right? So we've seen other companies that are not listed that have gone out and basically made public announcements about how they are investing into the future by buying ships that are lower rated. Lower rating can be many things. It's investing into that future, realizing that there are going to be alternative fuels, there are going to be new ship designs, and we have to be on the forefront of all of that. We certainly do everything we can, but we also, as responsible entities, need to make do and improve whatever we can that's out there. That was a long answer to the fact that I do think, and interestingly enough, I think that the Japanese have had a lot of trips in the recent past. That's or in the last couple of months, we see and hear from our Japanese colleagues that people are flocking to Japan to speak to the Japanese yacht groups to be sort of making a sort of safe bet on what are these tariffs potentially going to do.
Craig, maybe you want to continue this conversation. How do you see it in terms of the shipyards and the first mover advantage?
Absolutely. From the shipyard perspective, you know, I was just talking to my colleagues who just got back from Singapore Maritime Week last week, and they said every single discussion was around the USTR, what's happening in America, how that will impact. But the other interesting part of that was there was also really no discussion on delays, cancellations of these orders, but really just the impact. So I still think that will be, China will obviously play a major part there, and we'll see that. But they're also looking at options. They're talking to Korea. They're talking to, they're opening the horizons where maybe they wouldn't have in the past. But again, that's going to cause hesitancy now of where to order, and I think we'll see that continue to slow down. We've actually seen, if you look at the numbers now, compared to last year, we're at, 71 orders this year, alternative fuels, versus 82. So a 13% decline in alternative fuels already ordered this year. So again, that's kind of reflecting on the hesitancy. But kind of going into your next question about the first movers, I think it's you know, advantages and disadvantages to both. Obviously, on the advantages side, you're adopting the technology sooner, you're training your crew, you're getting all of this part of your organization, but you're taking a risk on going towards an uncertainty. Is this the fuel of the future? And that is kind of the picture that you have to print yourself of the flexibility. You're looking at dual fuel. You're looking at not putting all your eggs in one basket. That's very important as a first mover. But as a wait and see, then you wait, but then are you waiting too long? And are you going to miss the boats or are you going to miss the supply chain? You're not going to get the fuel you need. So in this matter, I think, you know, being a first mover is probably a little bit better.
Hey, John, that's a great question as well for you. Is the crew training aspect, the technology that needs to be brought aboard the vessels, unlike some other technologies like a scrubber, for example, that, you know, doesn't, you know, it's just installed effectively at the yard and probably doesn't require a high degree of technical skill or education to operate. Do you feel that operating fuel, you know, zero carbon vessels, hydrogen, ammonia, and the systems that go along with that, whether that will actually result in a first mover advantage?
I don't know about first mover advantage, but I can tell you that crew is a very important part of everybody's business. The safety of the crew is the most important, number one, and then being able to control the technology. Some of that technology is by design sent ashore, because now we have such, with digitalization, we have managed to get so much data in the cloud and be able to analyze it ashore and then guide the crew what to do next, how to perform the voyage, how to deal with the weather, when to arrive at port. So there's a number of operational, technical items that one has to look at, and the crew has to manage that, you know, energy efficiency, energy conservation, harvesting of energy. All these are going to be very important for the crew to learn. We do crew seminars at least two times a year, if not more, with more than 50 people, officers coming to these seminars. And we, the whole management, talk to them and explain to them what we're thinking, how we see the future, and how we want them to handle it.
Thank you, John. Let me just continue with you just for a second. We've heard a lot about nuclear propulsion. This is somewhat of a new conversation over the last several weeks, I would say. And maybe it's been around longer, but I think it's gotten more notoriety and news coverage over the last several weeks. How do you feel about a nuclear-powered gas carrier?
That'd be great. But I don't think it's here. But I think it's probably... I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
I think it's going to be more likely on a very large container ship where you need a lot of power and you need certainly a big plant to manage this ship, that type of ship.
No, I was just going to say that, I think, as a ship registry, we are fuel agnostic as well. I think nuclear is definitely on the table. It's been around for 70 years. The U.S. Navy uses nuclear. The U.S. Navy has 81 ships operating on nuclear propulsion. Most of them are submarines, and, it's definitely a viable option. So I wouldn't rule it out.
Yes, but what are you seeing across the management spectrum?
Well, I think we're obviously also not ruling it out. It's not that we've set up a training facility for it by now, I would say. So I think it's probably a little bit further out in the future. But returning to what you said before about being first mover, I think this is a point in case where, history always says that the second mouse gets the cheese. But I don't think that's the case here, actually. I think these are the kind of conversations where you get into if you are involved in alternative fuels, if you are involved in the nuclear conversation, if you are involved in energy-saving technologies that have not been tried before, if you engage with it, if you order ships, if you train crew, then you get conversations which you would not otherwise get. And I think that's what this is about at the moment. It may be that there is a lot of ships that are sailing around out there that have dual fuel capacity, and they may never actually, or at least not in the near future, they may not use alternative fuels. But because you have that as a capacity, you get to have the conversation with your customers. You get to understand what are the economics that are associated with it, which are very, very different to the ones that are sitting on the bench and just looking and watching and trying to learn from what others are doing.
I will say just that, if I may. Training a crew, I think, is very critical. When we talk to owners that have dual fuel LNG, especially on the new build side, the first or second question goes to safety of crew and training of crew and compliance with STCW and the IGF code. So, I think it's very important when you talk about crew, training is a critical element to safety.
Thanks. So with just the short amount of time we have left, let me come up the line here, starting with Lucas. And this is 2050 going to happen? Will we be net zero carbon by 2050? And just a couple of final thoughts.
It depends greatly on what the legislators will do, because as we all know that there will be a new MEPC next month, and there will be a decision towards the global fuel standard and the economic measure, the so-called levy. I think if we go again a step back, in order to achieve the targets, we had ahead of us clear solutions. First of all, the CII and the AER regulations, all the regulations that have been adopted until now, I believe they were quite successful because they have motivated large number of upgrades on vessels, which produced probably, I would say, about 10% of efficiency. Also, phase 3 vessels produce about 30% of efficiency. If you combine it with LNG, you can even go to 50% reduction of CO2 emissions, but it's very expensive, for example, on bulk carriers, because the cost of the construction is about 20 million, which is almost more than half of the price of the vessel. If you move now to alternative fuels, which is also a good solution, then people are trying to experiment with ammonia, which is very toxic. And I would say that at the end of the road, we need to have, I'm not saying now, but at the end of the road, we need to have nuclear power, because nuclear power is something which does not produce CO2 emissions. So either green energy from solar or wind or nuclear power is the end solution. And now the legislators will dictate how quickly we go. As we go right now, I don't believe that we can reach it, but I believe that this is how transition happens. Sometimes you go faster, sometimes you go slower, because there are events that happen. I mean, so if, let's say, climate change is more dramatic, then people need to react, and they will not think of the excessive cost of the energy if there are distractions everywhere. So the solution is what we have chosen. They're back and forth, but we see at the end of the route if we are
successful. We'll see when we get there. Jesper, how do you feel?
Well, we're certainly working towards it. I am not necessarily in agreement with the panelist that was here before and said that nuclear can be fully operational and spread out amongst different segments in 10 years. But I do think that the regulatory environment would pressure. We as consumers need to change behavior. The industry, I think, fundamentally has reached a point where they really do want to change. I think the access to alternative fuels with the current sort of geopolitical and political environment all over the world is getting delayed. But reality is that that's where it's going to come from. And, you know, we at least as a business continue to work and position ourselves to facilitate that a net zero is possible for ourselves and for our clients by 2050.
Humera, thumbs up or thumbs down on 2050?
I would say thumbs up, and the Liberian Registry is here to help our owners get there. And I think next week is going to be very critical in with MEPC 83 and the midterm measures coming down on the GHG fuel standard and then on the economic market measure. So I'm hopeful.
Greg?
So the goals are definitely ambitious. I do think they'll be difficult to achieve. They're going to require widespread behavior change from the industry and global, you know, cooperation to make it happen. But these are the reasons we set very ambitious goals to drive us to make change. So it is feasible, and DNV is doing everything we can to make it happen. I also want to say that decarbonization is two sides of a coin. You have, of course, what we've been talking about, the alternative fuels, and this is what we need to plan and invest in because that is the future. But right now, if the best fuel is the fuel you're not burning, so what are you doing to be more efficient? What technologies are you adapting? What are you doing to save that fuel today? And these are investments that have shorter ROIs and may make sense in different segments. So you have to think about both in a parallel time.
Thank you, Craig. And John, you have the first and last word.
Good points. Very good points. Maybe carbon neutrality, but not zero, is most likely event that I expect. In shipping, I don't think we can do zero, but I think neutral we can do it. It is possible.
Thank you very much. So let me wrap it up. Thank you all. I thought that was a fantastic panel, and thank you all for listening. Thank you to the Capital Link team, Nicolas, Olga, and the team. And I look forward to seeing you all later this afternoon. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.